Metcalf, Sunday, January 26th, 2020. Hey, Met Geeks, it's time for your Metcast, the show for Met Geeks by Met Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the Maccast. Glad to have you back here with me. Another week of Mac and Apple news. Hopefully you are doing well. I am still fighting the fight of these illnesses that have been going around. Nothing super serious, but, on and off and doing my battles, but we're going to get through this one. Hopefully you're feeling fine and not having any issues, because like I said, we do have quite a few things to get into in the Apple and Mac news this week. We are going to be taking a look at 2020 iPhones and how that technology might be shaping up, what we might expect to see in our devices this year. We're going to talk a little bit about iCloud encryption, Apple getting into a little bit of a scuffle this past week or so over their encryption and what's going on in iCloud. We're going to talk about some of the stuff they're doing there. I'm going to talk about maybe a new keyboard for your iPad, get into Apple TV subscription numbers, some surprising results going on there, and then a bunch, and I am not kidding, a bunch of Apple TV Plus news to get into. Lots of things happened over the past week or so, and we'll even talk a little bit about Mac shipments in 2019, and that's going to round out the news for the episode this week. Then we're going to get into some of your feedback, a lot of follow-up on some of the things we've been talking about on past episodes of the show. We'll get back into enhanced Apple Maps. I've got some follow-up for cleaning tips on your Apple keyboards. We'll talk about data export of your Apple Card data, and I've then got a bunch of Apple TV tips and tricks for you, and we'll follow up on some of my comments about the Apple TV and over-the-air content. I got some great recommendations from you on options for dealing with that, and like I said, this should be a great episode, so I say we get right to it. And before we get started, I do want to take a moment and thank a show sponsor. And I want to talk to you about Smile. Our friends at Smile, they are a great company, make a ton of great apps, and have been a supporter of the show for a very, very long time. And what I want to talk to you about today is PDF Pen, because it is the ultimate tool for editing your PDFs on the Mac. And they're all the way at version 11. Smile has always done a great job of updating the app, keeping up to date with the latest and greatest features that you're going to want. And right now is when I start to give PDF Pen even more of a workout than I do on a daily basis. That's because we're in tax season. Yeah, we don't like to talk about it too much, but PDF Pen can really help make it go much more smoothly for you. I use it for all sorts of things, like adding signatures to my documents, filling out forms, even what I call those fake forms, you know, the things that look like PDF forms, but they don't have any form fields. Yeah, PDF Pen is a champ at doing that, especially if you have PDF Pen Pro. You can just automatically recognize and find those fields. It will turn your fake forms into actual PDF forms. It's also great for marking up documents for my tax professional. I can add notes and information, put things on there that they might need, anything that I need to point out. And then best of all, I can also use PDF Pen to secure those documents with encryption and a password so I can send them securely back to my tax professional. Very important in this day and age, especially with things like tax documentation where you have sensitive data and information that you don't want getting out there. PDF Pen also OCRs your PDFs, so that makes them easily searchable when you need to find that critical information. And it has a ton of other features too. Like I said, you can create and edit PDF forms with PDF Pen Pro. And the latest version, PDF Pen 11.2, lets you easily edit the content inside table cells. It gets better and better with age. So if you don't have a copy of PDF Pen, now would be a great time to pick one up. If you're already a user and you're not up to date with the latest version, good time to upgrade and get up to date with PDF Pen. Best of all, PDF Pen for Mac supports macOS Catalina, and PDF Pen for iPad and iPhone is already iOS 13 ready. So you can take your documents back and forth. I guess that's another great feature I forgot to mention is it is cross-device. So you can go through iCloud, you can get your PDFs on your Mac, on your iPad, on your iPhone, and you can do all those things that you need to do. So it's another great feature I use when my tax professional says, hey, you forgot that document, and I'm not near my Mac, I maybe only have my iPhone with me, I can still pull up that document and email it off and get it right over to them. So no delays. Great piece of software. Be sure to check out all the other great applications from Smile. SmileSoftware.com/podcast is the place to go to check it out and get more information. And as always, a huge thank you to Smile for their support of the podcast. Let's get into some of the latest reports on iPhone. Something we had been talking about recently was reports that had indicated that this year's iPhones will add 5G support, but it might not add full 5G support, that we would get just the sub 6 gigahertz flavor and maybe not the mmWave. We might have to wait until 2021 to see that. Well, this week, some good news, because Ming-Chi Kuo believes that this year's models will support both versions of 5G, depending upon the region that you're in. He says mmWave will be supported in 5 markets, including the United States, Canada, Japan, Korea, and the United Kingdom. He also thinks that Apple could disable 5G functionality in places that have no support for 5G or limited support for 5G technologies. I assume this would be so that Apple could save on having to pay licensing fees for devices that really can't use or take advantage of the technology. Then in a future update, they could enable that when it makes sense. So I think that's likely to happen. You know, Apple's going to want to support 5G in the broadest way they can, especially here in 2020 with other devices coming out with 5G support, including mmWave support. So they're going to want to stay competitive. So I never really bought the fact that they would kind of only use the sub 6 gigahertz version, but that's what we were hearing early on. It's good to hear now that Ming-Chi Kuo thinks otherwise. This year's batch of iPhones are also expected to come in 3 different sizes. I found the size rumors a bit interesting because they're saying 5.4 inches, 6.1 inch, which is normal for, say, the iPhone 11 device, and then 6.7 inches. So you might notice the little anomaly there. It looks like the update to the iPhone 11 Pro is going to be slightly smaller, whereas the iPhone 11 Pro Max is going to be slightly larger. So the iPhone 11 Pro update this year going to 5.4 inches from 5.7, and the iPhone 11 Pro Max going from 6.5 inches to 6.7 inches. So they're kind of, you know, extending the range of sizes. And I don't know how I feel about that. I've gotten kind of used to my 5.7 inch. Going down to 5.4 might feel a little bit too small, but if all they're doing is maybe reducing bezels and keeping the screen sizes about the same, then I could be okay with that. But we haven't really heard that as being the way they're going to kind of get that phone size down. They are all expected to be OLED displays. That includes the updated iPhone 11 device, that 6.1 inch device, and its size does seem to be staying the same. The front-facing cameras are also all expected to get a 3D time-of-flight sensor update that is supposedly to support AR applications and do more 3D VR kinds of things on your device, and not much word on what's going to happen with the true depth camera system, if that's going to change or not. One rumor I guess we did hear early on was that Apple might try to reduce the size of the notch, kind of minimize that a little bit more, and I think there's some people are still even hoping they might be able to cram it just into the bezel so that it doesn't sort of encroach on the display. But I think Apple will stick with the notch probably for another year. I think many of us have gotten used to it and, you know, really realized it's not such a big deal. There is one other iPhone we're hearing about Apple updating this year, and it could be coming just around the corner. That would be the update to the lower cost iPhone SE, something a lot of people have been calling early on the iPhone SE 2. I've called the iPhone SE 8. because it does sound like it's going to get a form factor that's closer to the 8. And what's bringing this on is that Apple has had a lot of success this year with the lower cost iPhone 11. As a matter of fact, I believe we talked about in a previous episode of the MacCast that it was the best selling iPhone over the last couple quarter or last quarter or so. Rumors are that Apple could release an even lower cost option this March, basically replacing the iPhone SE, or I guess bringing about the return of a phone in the same price range as the iPhone SE. The design is actually expected to be exactly the same as the iPhone 8, which is why you kind of gave it that clever name. It would be a 4.7-inch LCD display, would have a single rear-facing camera lens, although I think we did hear that it might get a dual-lens camera system. I would think just for cost reasons, Apple might stick with a single lens, and it will not include Face ID. It will stick with Touch ID, again, to bring the cost down. But on the good side of things, it is expected to be updated with more RAM and Apple's latest A13 processor. As far as storage, I did not see anything talking about storage, but I would hope and imagine that Apple would do a 64 gigabyte version, and I would imagine it would just come in one storage size, although I could see them also offering a 128 gigabyte option. But I think for simplicity and price point, they might just go with a single model. It could possibly be dubbed the iPhone 9, so we might get actually the missing iPhone 9, because if you remember, they went from iPhone 8 to iPhone 10, and there was no 9, so maybe that's what they'll give it. I don't think they're going to call it an iPhone SE 2, and it is expected to be priced around the same as the starting price for the iPhone SE at about $399 US. So that would be significantly lower than I think the starting price point of the iPhone 11, which I believe is $649. I probably should have looked that up before I started the podcast, but I didn't. I think that's the right price point, just going off memory. But it should be a nice iPhone lineup this year. Like I said, we could have one as early as March with this new low-cost iPhone. And then, of course, all of the other models are expected to come out around the usual time frame in the fall. That would be about the October range. So what do you think? Are you excited about this year's iPhone lineup? I know there's probably a lot of people excited about a lower cost option, especially if you have kids or maybe are just on a little bit tighter budget. And the fact that Apple would go with the latest technology means you could buy that device and have a very nice device for years to come. So I hope Apple does that, and hopefully we'll hear that announcement coming up here in the next few months. This week, we had another dust-up with the iCloud encryption debate because of some information that came out related to the FBI. Before we get into the story, though, I thought we'd go over a little bit of background just so we're all on the same page. Your iCloud messages, as you may or may not know, are in transit, end-to-end encrypted, and when you're sending messages back and forth via iCloud messages, your devices have the keys to then decrypt that data, decrypt and encrypt. So that means your messages over the air as they're going back and forth are not easily hacked. End-to-end encryption requires that you do have two-factor authentication turned on for your Apple ID, but as long as that is going on, that is what happens. Now, it gets a little bit different when you're talking about backing up your messages in iCloud, inside your iCloud backups. That and other data like your contacts, your calendar data, and your photos, those are encrypted and stored encrypted when they are on Apple's servers, but they don't use the end-to-end flavor of encryption. What that means is that even though they're encrypted on Apple's servers, Apple does have a key to be able to decrypt that. And of course, you have a key on your device as well. Apple has a key because many people, and they've said this a few times, tend to when they lose or break their devices, lose access or can't remember their iCloud passwords. That means when they get a new device and they're trying to restore, they cannot get their data back from their iCloud backup. And Apple has erred on the side of caution here, and went with a system where they could support customers and help them recover their data. Now, not all data is like that. There is some special cases for your iCloud backup data, and that would be things like home data, health data, your iCloud keychain, any payment information, vocabulary words learned by your QuickType keyboard, screen time information, Siri information, and your Wi-Fi passwords. Those are all encrypted end-to-end when stored on iCloud in your backups, and Apple cannot decrypt that type of data. So we're talking about very specific information. Another reason why Apple likes to have the keys is, say, for iCloud Photos and iCloud Photo Library. That's what enables you to be able to access that through the iCloud.com website. When you sign in, same thing goes for your files and documents and email and all of that sort of stuff. So they use those keys on the server as well to decrypt that data so they can display it to you when you're securely logged in with your web browser. Now, the dust up that happened this week came from a story that reported that Apple had backed off on plans to end-to-end encrypt all of your iCloud data, something they have said a few times that they're working toward. But this report said that Apple had backed off on those plans due to some pressure from the FBI. More specifically, they said that Apple shared with the FBI that they had plans to do end-to-end encryption and that the FBI had asked them not to do that and that they basically kowtowed to that request. Now, the reason why this would matter to the FBI, government agencies, or law enforcement is that currently, under court orders, Apple can provide access to iCloud backups, and they can use that data in investigations. Now, if Apple enabled end-to-end encryption, that would no longer be a possibility. And Apple does, through court subpoenas and when this information is requested through legal channels, they do provide that data. As a matter of fact, you can go on their privacy website through their transparency reports and see how many times they do this, how many requests are processed. And as a matter of fact, in the first half of last year, Apple provided data for about 160,000 devices, processing about 82% of these requests. So they don't always follow through on these requests. It depends on the circumstances, but very often when it comes through legal channels, they do. Now, the report that Apple had backed off came through Reuters, and they cited six sources that told them that Apple caved to the FBI demands to not go forward on plans to end-to-end encrypt iCloud data. I personally, despite the fact that they had that many sources, and it is Reuters, which is a reliable source, I would hope and think that they do their due diligence in fact-checking their reports. I still kind of find it highly unlikely, as do some other prominent members of the Mac community, including Rene Ritchie over at iMore and John Gruber, both who wrote up some great pieces on this. Check out the latest Vector from iMore and John Gruber's Daring Fireball blog for more information. But I tend to agree with them. It seems like there are some things going on here that are merely coincidences. I do believe that Apple is and still is planning on trying to do end-to-end encryption through iCloud. I also feel like they maybe decided that they're not ready to do it yet. And so it's entirely possible that they're, you know, with current FBI investigations going on and them getting help from Apple, that it's merely a coincidence in terms of the timing of this report. Internally, Apple may have decided not to roll forward with end-to-end encryption yet, and it's being sort of translated into this report that Apple is backing off because the FBI is requesting it. I do think also that the FBI is aware that Apple wants to do end-to-end encryption, and they probably have requested that Apple not do it. But I don't think the fact that both those things are happening at the same time necessarily means that Apple isn't rolling forward with end-to-end encryption because the FBI doesn't want them to do it. As a matter of fact, Apple in the past has never shown any hesitation in standing up to FBI demands. And historically, they make decisions that are more consumer-focused or 100% consumer-focused. And that's what they have always said. So I think it is more likely that currently they're erring on the side of the consumer when it comes to being able to provide customer support for locked accounts and consumers getting access to their data. I think this is a tricky technical problem for Apple to figure out how they can do end-to-end encryption and still not have people lose the ability to recover their data. And so until they can do that, I think they're not going to enable end-to-end iCloud encryption. Now, that said, I do think that it would be nice if they could offer savvy customers a choice to enable end-to-end encryption after accepting the risk that if they do, Apple is not going to have the keys and they're not going to be able to help recover their data should you forget your password and lose your recovery keys. Because when you enable encryption for other things like File Vault on your computer, for example, you are warned about this and they will tell you up front, hey, if you lose your keys, you lose your password, we're not going to be able to decrypt the stuff, and basically, you will lose your data. And I think if you're willing to accept that risk, you should be able to enable this feature. Why Apple hasn't done that yet is a little bit puzzling to me. So that's kind of my take on this. I really don't think that Apple is making decisions based on what the FBI wants. I think they make decisions based on their own technology, on consumers' wants and needs, and that's really all there is to it. Another example of this, maybe, where Apple makes a choice kind of for the consumer is something we talked about on the MacCast previously, and that's the new feature in iOS 13, which constantly notifies you when you have apps using your location data in the background. Apple has decided that you should be constantly aware that apps use data in the background when they have that feature turned on, and they will even remind you for apps that you've already approved for background data. We talked about the fact this is a little bit annoying personally to me on the show in the past. I don't like getting the notifications, but I do understand why Apple has made this decision. They don't want you to forget that, hey, this app is using your background data. And it turns out that this is become a highly effective way for apps to not be able to track you as much as they have in the past. Fast Company reported on new data from location marketing firm Location Sciences. They say since iOS 13's release, the amount of background data that marketers have been collecting on iOS devices has dropped by 68%. Almost 70% of people are reducing the amount of background location data that their apps are collecting. They also say the amount of foreground data, that's the location data that's collected when the app is opened, has also dropped about 25%. So it is working. We are making ourselves more secure and protecting our privacy more when it comes to our location data. I just wish that there was a way for me to say, yep, permanently, I don't want to be reminded that this app is using location data in the background. I hope that's something that Apple adjusts as a setting in a future version of iOS. But at least for now, they are helping us protect our privacy. There is a rumor this week that Apple may be trying to make your iPad a little bit more like your MacBook Pro. This is according to the DigiTimes. They say that Apple could release a new version of their smart keyboard with the next generation of iPads, and that that new version may feature scissor switch keys. This could mean that the new keyboard on iPads has a feel much more like the new scissor switch keyboard on the 2019 16-inch MacBook Pro. I don't know if it would have the same sort of plastic keys or if they would still have kind of the fabric-covered keys that they currently use. But back in July last year, Ming-Chi Kuo said that Apple would be sticking with the rubber dome switches in the iPad keyboards, the same ones that we have currently with the 2020 and 2021 models. So we do have a little bit of conflicting evidence here. We'll have to see if Ming-Chi Kuo changes his report, maybe based on the same new information that DigiTimes is hearing about. Historically, I would say Ming-Chi Kuo has a little bit better track record than DigiTimes, but just the thought of a scissor switch smart keyboard design is very interesting. It could be possible that Apple could do two versions of the keyboard, I guess. One more like the traditional keyboard and maybe a smart keyboard pro, that would have the scissor switch keys. That wasn't spelled out in this DigiTimes report, but something that I did think about as I was starting to write up the story. I don't know what you think about it, but would it make sense to kind of have a more pro keyboard? Maybe it would be more of a hard case design, maybe something similar or more similar to the Logitech keyboards that we've seen for the iPad Pro. I don't know. What do you think? There's also a rumor that Apple might also add 5G Wi-Fi support with mmWave technology to this year's iPad Pro as well. And I do think that makes sense to go along with the update to 5G on the iPhone. If Apple is going to go 5G and they are going to support both technologies, I do think they would do that across the board. There was a report that came out this week about Apple TV Plus and its subscriber numbers. Of course, Apple isn't giving out any official numbers. They haven't made any statements about it other than to say that they were very happy with how the subscriber numbers were going. So this is all a little bit speculative, but the report cited by the Wall Street Journal says that a survey of subscribers showed that in the fourth quarter of 2019, Apple TV Plus came out looking pretty good. It scored third behind Netflix and Amazon Prime with an estimated 33.6 million subscribers. The most surprising thing about this is that it reportedly beat out Hulu at 31.8 million subscribers and the new Disney Plus service with 23.2 million. Now, to be fair, there are two big factors that we have to mention here, kind of elephants in the room. One is that Apple is currently offering a free year of service to anybody who purchased an iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or Apple Watch after September 10th, 2019. So that is no doubt helping their early numbers. And it is also worth pointing out that Disney Plus did not launch their service until about halfway through the quarter. So they obviously did very, very well at 23.2 million, considering they had about half the time as some of the other services. But also, to be fair to Apple, Disney Plus launched just 11 days after Apple's November 1st launch. So Apple launched November 1st, so they didn't have a full quarter either. So either way, the numbers are looking very good for both services. I do expect that Apple will decline a little bit. Disney Plus is very, very strong. Obviously, their offering it has a lot more depth, and it's probably much more appealing to consumers. But as we have said in the past, and as Apple has stated themselves, they're not going after quantity. They are looking for more of quality. And I really see Apple TV Plus as a separate kind of service. It really is something that's designed to be additive. It's priced at a price point, $4.99 a month, that it's really not likely trying to compete with the likes of Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, or Disney Plus. And I think Apple should be very, very happy and imagine that they're going to talk about it at the next quarterly results call. The fact that they're very happy with their subscriber numbers. The big question is going to be, are they going to be able to retain those subscribers after those trial periods end? And I have a feeling once you hear the next bit of news with their latest lineup that they have a pretty good chance. They are going to be expanding the service very rapidly, and they have some great content in the pipeline. So let's talk about that a little bit. Even more Apple TV Plus news this week. As a matter of fact, as I said at the top of the show, there is a bunch of it. We'll try to just rattle through this real quickly. Apple TV Plus has brought in their first couple of awards in the awards season for TV. The big show that brought them the awards is The Morning Show, something that I had held off on watching and found that I really did enjoy once I finally got around to it. I started with, you know, the nerdy, more nerdy stuff, I would think. See, the sci-fi show starring Jason Momoa, also For All Mankind and Dickinson. But when I did get around to The Morning Show, I found it to be really great. And apparently, a number of the awards shows did as well. Billy Crudup was the first to win an award with a Best Supporting Actor at the Critic Choice Awards. And then not long after that, Jennifer Aniston won the award for Outstanding Performance by a Female Actor in a Drama Series at the Screen Actors Guild Awards. So Apple doing very well in winning a couple of awards right out of the gate, just a few months after launching the service. Apple also announced its full Apple TV Plus lineup for this year at South by Southwest. We got a number of new shows. Apple will release the Beastie Boys documentary called The Beastie Boys Story, directed by Spike Jonze, in April. It will have at first a limited theatrical run in IMAX theaters before showing up on the Apple TV Plus service. Apple also announced a number of new original shows, a docu-series called Home that will take a look at the world's most innovative homes, Central Park, an animated musical series from the creator of Bob's Burgers, executive produced by Nora Smith and Josh Gad, Dear, which is going to be a new documentary series by R.J. Cutler. Dear draws inspiration from Apple's own Dear Apple advertiser, Apple advertisements that feature customers reading written testimonials about Apple products. Instead of customer stories, though, the 10-episode series will focus on stars like Oprah Winfrey, Broadway star Lin-Manuel Miranda, gymnast Ali Raisman, Spike Lee, and more. The one I am really excited about is Amazing Stories. This was actually announced in the first lineup or announcement of Apple TV Plus shows, but we now finally have a release date. The first 5 episodes will be released on March 6th. Amazing Stories is a reboot of the 80s sci-fi anthology series produced by Steven Spielberg. I think it had 2 seasons in its original run, and I really loved that show, so I'm hoping the new Apple TV Plus version is just as great. I would imagine it might even be better, considering the fact that they have much better technology for special effects and other things. But it really is about the storytelling, and that was one of the things that I loved about Amazing Stories originally, is it did have great, compelling stories. Defending Jacob is also another series that will debut on April 24th. This is a drama series that unfolds around a shocking crime in a small Massachusetts town. It stars Chris Evans and Michelle Dockery. Home Before Dark will premiere on April 3rd. This is the one based on the real-life child journalist Hildy Lysak. And Apple's first UK series called Trying will launch on May 1st, and it's described as a show about growing up, settling down, and finding someone to love. So that will kind of round out the lineup of upcoming shows here in 2020. There might be a few more along the way. I think Apple could surprise us, but that's all we know about for now. As far as what is in the works, Apple did have some announcements related to that this week as well. Apple signed a multi-year exclusive deal with Julia Louise Dreyfus to develop new projects for Apple TV+. She will both produce and star in shows for Apple. And in a statement about the partnership, she did throw in a pretty good joke. She said that she was excited that her representatives were able to structure the deal so that she would be paid in AirPods. Another bit of news that came this week was that Apple has finished reviewing the controversial information surrounding their first original film, The Banker, and they have announced that they will ultimately end up releasing the film on Apple TV Plus in March. You may or may not remember that Apple delayed the release, which was set to happen in December last year, after accusations about historical inaccuracy and sexual abuse came to light. The sexual abuse accusations surrounded the son of one of the main characters, although he is not depicted in the film, and the film stars Anthony Mackie and Samuel L. Jackson. It was a title that was much anticipated. It looks like a great story, and I, for one, am glad Apple has decided to release it, despite all of the controversy. And then finally, related to Apple TV, Apple started reminding customers this past week or so that have not activated their free year of Apple TV Plus that they have 90 days from purchasing their device, their qualifying device, to sign up. And the reason those notifications started going out is because the clock started ticking on November 1st for anybody who had purchased a qualifying product on or after September 10th, 2019. So you basically had 90 days from November 1st if you had purchased a device before November 1st. And that's why those reminders started going out. Now, if you purchased a new device today, a new qualifying device today, you would still get a full 90 days. So it's not that they just had 90 days from launch. It is 90 days from purchasing your qualifying device. And you will qualify for that just one time. So if you buy another device later and you've already signed up for your free year of Apple TV, you only get that offer once per qualifying device, and it is only once per family. So if you have multiple devices in a family and are using family plans, then it is the only a one-time offer. But those notifications did start going out, so you may or may not have seen one of those if you hadn't activated a free subscription. And then finally, in the news for this week, the latest IDC data for Q4 2019 PC sales are out, and the numbers for Mac seem to show what Apple is probably already aware of. That is the fact that we are just not buying Macs as often or as frequently as we used to. This is despite the fact that overall PC shipments grew 4.8% in the quarter, according to IDC. They estimate that Apple shipped about 4.7 million Macs in the quarter, which would put them down about 5.3% year over year. And IDC wasn't the only ones to show that Mac sales are slumping a little bit. Gartner also released their numbers, although over there Apple did fare a little bit better. They estimated that Apple sold 5.26 million Macs in the quarter, down just 2.3% year over year. And again, I don't find any of this surprising given the current state of the Apple ecosystem. Macs, as we know, are lasting a lot longer. They continue to perform very well. The operating system is supported on older Macs much further back. And I think a lot of us are supplementing our computing tasks with other devices like our iPhones and iPads. I know for my part, my Mac, my current workhorse Mac that I use to record the show, is a 2015 MacBook Pro, and it is still going strong, and I currently have no plans to replace it anytime soon. So it's already a five-year-old Mac. I would expect I get another at least year or two of use out of it, maybe even longer. We'll have to see. And in fact, for my entire household, I have a 2006 Mac Mini, a 2009 iMac, a 2011 MacBook Air, and a 2013 MacBook Pro, all in active use, not all mine, of course, other family members and things like that, and all of them are working great. So I'm not really in the market for a new Mac, yet I do get a new iPhone every year and occasionally will get a new iPad, although my iPad upgrades are also slowing quite a bit, and I think we've seen that reflected in iPad sales as well. So, you know, is it doom and gloom for Apple? I don't think so. I think this is a classic case of Apple cannibalizing their own stuff. And Tim Cook, I think, said way, way, way back when that he fully expects that iPads are going to eat into Mac sales. And I think we are finally seeing that. And I think this is ultimately a good thing. And Apple still making quite a bit of profit, the stock doing just fine. So I don't think we need to worry about them, although it was interesting to see the slowing a little bit in these numbers. A few other little tidbits of Mac news before we finish up the news for this week. Mac Pro is now available in rack mount form. If you're in the market for a big beefy server and you want to go Mac, this could be a good option for you, although it will cost you a little bit. They start at $6,500 US, about $500 more if you want to rack mount your Mac Pro, and the specs are overall the same otherwise. So you're going to pay for the privilege of sticking that thing in a rack, but man, how sexy a rack looking thing that is going to look, you know, it will definitely kind of outshine the other rack mounted devices in your IT data center. We're also hearing that Apple could be possibly working out new iMac designs for the future, and that one of those designs could be an all-glass iMac with an embedded display. This comes about because of a patent that was recently discovered for an electronic device with glass housing member. This, of course, is an Apple patent. It shows a curved glass bottom forming the stand with a kind of wedge that would hold it up, and then the display is embedded in this all-glass, beautifully curved-looking thing. It really does look like a piece of art. The wedge at the bottom also serves to house the ports, connections, power, and peripherals. And there is another version of the device that shows a slot that kind of indicates a maybe docking functionality for a MacBook Pro. And what's interesting is the slot in the bottom serves as a place where you slide through the MacBook Pro keyboard, and the keyboard on the MacBook Pro becomes the keyboard for the desktop Mac. It's an interesting little setup, and it seems a little weird, though, because you now have sort of one display, a large display sandwiched on top of your smaller MacBook Pro display. So rather than operating in clamshell mode, you basically sort of mate the two. I guess they kind of spoon is a good way to describe it. You spoon your MacBook with the desktop display, and now you have a whole new desktop computing experience. So whether or not this stuff will come to fruition is anybody's guess. It is only a patent, and Apple patents all kinds of thoughts and ideas. But what is interesting about this is it gives you some insight into possible thoughts that Apple is having about future iMac designs and all-in-one computer designs and docking designs and just all of that stuff. So it is interesting to look at and speculate about. It certainly does look beautiful, and it does look like something that Apple could try to put together. So we know that Johnny Ive wanted someday to have the iPhone just be a single pane of glass, and it's not too far a stretch to think that maybe they wanted to do something similar for our desktop Macs, and this is just kind of an indication of that thinking. But what do you think about that? You know, what are your thoughts and ideas maybe for an update to the iMac design? We've kind of had the design that we've had for a while now. What would take it to the next level? What would make it even more interesting and sexy and all those sorts of things? I'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas. If you want to share them with me, shoot me an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a moment and thank another show sponsor, and I want to talk to you about ExpressVPN. Now, we've talked a lot in the past about the advantages of using a VPN to protect your security and privacy, especially when you're surfing online, especially when maybe you're surfing online from a place that you are not in control of, not at your home network, although they are great when you're at home, but maybe when you're out and about, you're at a hotel, you're at a Wi-Fi hotspot at a restaurant or a coffee shop. Yeah, you want to protect yourself from any prying eyes that might be on that network. You know, that shady guy with the hacker stickers on his PC over in the corner. Yeah, you know that guy. You've seen him there. And ExpressVPN has been my go-to VPN for about a year now. What I really love about it is how easy it is to use. Literally install the app, choose your VPN location, and click a button, and you are protected. It really is that easy, and I found the connection to be super fast, super reliable, and I love the fact that it works with all of my devices, my Mac, my iPad, my iPhone. It's just as easy to implement on any of them. But there also is another handy use for ExpressVPN, and that comes into play when you're trying to maybe access streaming content that might not be in your country or location. I recently had to deal with this when I was trying to access Doctor Who. It had been on Netflix for a while, but they pulled it in 2016. They moved it over to Prime, and when I finally got around to wanting to watch it, they had pulled it from there as well. But it was still available on Netflix in the UK. And using ExpressVPN, I could connect to a VPN in the UK, and I was able to access and watch that content. And ExpressVPN has access to almost 100 different countries, so it could do the same for your favorite shows and content as well. And best of all, if you visit my special link right now, expressvpn.com/mattcast, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. So you can support the show, you can watch what you want, and you can protect yourself at expressvpn.com/mattcast. And a big thank you to them for their support of the show. I think we have another wrinkle in our story about Apple's updated enhanced map data rollout. The rollout that they were supposed to finish in the U.S. in 2019, and toward the end of 2019, we received reports that Apple had finished the rollout, that they had finally updated the states in the Midwest and the Southeast with the updated enhanced mapping data. This is the data that shows more green spaces, more rivers, includes the building outlines for buildings, and a lot more street level data. The stuff that Apple has basically been working on for the past 2 to 3 years. And it had been rolled out on the East Coast and on the West Coast, and they were slowly making their way inland. And I even reported, after we saw reports that the data had been finished on several websites, I reported it here on the MacCast. And almost immediately, I received emails from a number of listeners pointing out that the data was not there for them. And I had one listener who was in Iowa who had specifically pointed this out to me. And when I went to check, sure enough, he was right. There was not updated data for his town in Iowa. And when I looked at the map, I could see a huge swath running from the Midwest all the way down through the Southeast and down into Florida, where it didn't look like there was updated data. And basically, the way you could tell if the data is updated or not is if you look at the map and you see a lot of beige or gray instead of a lot of varying shades of green, those areas that are more beige don't have the updated or enhanced mapping data. And so I followed up my initial report with a correction saying, oh, hey, it looks like they might not have rolled out that data. Well, this week I received an email again from this listener in Iowa who said, oops, I was wrong. I actually do have updated data for my region. And I was a little bit puzzled by this. I went back to look, and lo and behold, yeah, the big middle section of the state or of the United States that I saw with missing data was suddenly filled in and looking lush and green and all that great stuff. And so I was like, great, it has been updated. But now we do have, like I said, a new wrinkle in this story, and I need your help in figuring this out. Hopefully someone at Apple is listening and can explain this to me, because the reality is both situations appear to be true, at least from my perspective. Now, I'm running macOS Catalina, the very latest version of the Mac operating system. I'm running iOS 13 on all my devices, the latest version of iOS. And here's what's going on. On my Mac, I don't have the updated enhanced data for the Midwest and Southeastern parts of the United States. But on my iOS devices, the enhanced data is there. And the weird thing about that to me is I would think the data is coming from the same place. And also, there is no way to manually refresh or update your data on your devices. It actually comes streaming down from Apple. So I don't know if there's some sort of cache that I need to clear or something that I can wipe out, or if there's a way to force the Mac to re-download the updated data. I think it's supposed to just happen automatically. So maybe there's actually a bug. Maybe Apple is rolling it out in stages. I am just really, really confused. So if anybody has an answer to this one, I would love to know it. But apparently, if you want to get the most up-to-date, most updated data, you're going to want to use your iOS device, at least for now, or at least until we can figure out this anomaly. If you do happen to know an answer, shoot me an email, send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. But good to know that Apple probably has finished actually doing the enhanced rollout of all of the data to the US. It's just we might not be able to see it every place all the time yet. The other thing that I hope, and this is just me being greedy, that they'll get working on next and will roll out more quickly is the updates to the look around feature, which I've talked about here on the MacCast. That's Apple's Street View sort of mode, and it is incredible. It's amazing, but right now it's only available in a handful of places, including places like Los Angeles and Honolulu, Hawaii. So hopefully Apple will roll it out to more cities and towns quickly, and I can't wait to see those updates as well. Another thing we talked about here recently on the MacCast was I gave a bunch of tips for helping you clean your Mac keyboards. And this came about because there is a new feature in the latest MacBooks, 2018 and 2019 models, I believe, where when you press any key on your keyboard, rather than just having a power key, but any key on the keyboard, it will actually wake up or power on your Mac. And the dilemma there is, how do you clean the keyboard? Because most of us really want to clean the keyboard with the Mac powered down so it doesn't have power going to the keys, especially if you're using any kind of damp cloth or liquid. And of course, you always want to be careful with liquids around your keyboard. So I always advise, if you are going to use a damp cloth, that you simply get a lint-free cloth, put a little bit of moisture on it, maybe spritz it with a little bit of water, but very, very lightly. Make sure that it is only slightly damp and not soaking wet, and then go ahead and use that to clean your keyboard with the power off, if you can do that. We did give a couple of tips and workarounds on a previous episode, but I also had a couple of people write in with some additional tips for cleaning your keyboard. And one that I thought was particularly good, and something that I actually do, but failed to mention on the MacCast, is something that came from John. He wrote in and said, "Hey, you know what? I recommend that when you're cleaning the keyboard, you actually invert it. You turn it upside down with the keys sort of facing the floor. Actually, it really works best if you get it at about a 45 degree angle. But the point is that you have the keys pointing down toward the ground, and you're not just wiping the keyboard keys with them facing up, because you would have the potential of further pushing in or wiping debris into the keyboard. By putting it upside down or at an angle, as you're wiping, it can actually loosen debris, and that debris is free to fall out of the keyboard. And it makes cleaning also have the added step of maybe cleaning out some of the crud and debris. Also, you may want to take a little can of compressed air, shoot some air under the keys. That's actually something that Apple had recommended for those folks who were having issues with stuck keys on the butterfly keyboards with the Mac. So I thought that was a great tip, and thank you, John, for sending that in. When Apple finally launched their Apple Card, a lot of us were very excited to get access to those, and I have loved using the Apple Card. I love daily cash back, all those fun things. I'm hoping Apple will quickly roll out the Apple Card to a bunch of other regions. But a big complaint that came up with Apple Card was the fact that because it's managed through your iOS devices, through the Apple Pay app or Apple Pay settings, it is not easy to export data. And as a matter of fact, Apple did not have any integration with any kind of banking apps like Mint or Quicken and such. And without any kind of export features other than exporting a PDF, there was no way to import that data into those programs. Well, Apple has corrected that this past week, and you now can actually export that information. Although you still can't do a direct connection to those third-party apps, and that is because of Apple's focus on privacy. They don't want those apps having access to your banking information and data. So what they have provided is the ability to actually export a CSV file that you can then import into those other apps. Most banking apps do support CSV import. So if you would like to do that, there is a way to do it now. The way you do it is you open up the wallet app, you tap on the Apple Card, then you tap on the card balance. That will show you a listing of your statements. You can tap on the statement that you want to export, and then you will see a button for an item for export transactions. If you tap on that, it will pull up a list of your transactions in a table view, and then you can tap the share icon and then save it out to the Files app, save it to something like Dropbox. You can email it. You have a number of different options that you can take advantage of for saving out or sharing out that file. And you do end up with a CSV file that you can then import into any application you wish. So that's how you can now export your card statement from your Apple Card. We had quite a bit of Apple TV Plus news on the show this week, and so I thought it would be a great opportunity to continue our conversation about the Apple TV with some Apple TV tips. I ran across quite a few this week. Some of them came up from listeners who sent them in via email. A few others are just things that I ran across or I've been dealing with my own Apple TV. And one tip that I discovered recently has to do with Apple's beautiful aerial screensavers. These are the slow motion aerial shot screensavers that are like the default on the Apple TVs. They're beautiful, but very often I've had one come up and I've seen it briefly and I want to see it again. And I really didn't know how you could go through those. And it turns out that it's surprisingly simple. I'm actually shocked that I missed it, but I did discover this over the past couple weeks. And so I thought maybe there's others of you out there who don't know this trick either. I'm sure there's many who do, but you can easily switch screensavers when the screensaver comes up by simply grabbing your Apple Siri remote and swiping on the trackpad to the right. If you swipe to the right, it will go to the next screensaver. If you've just missed one and it's changed, you can swipe the other direction, swipe to the left, and scroll back through the screensaver. So you can swipe through, find the one you like, and have that up on your TV. Another quick tip too is if you want to know what the screensaver is, what you're looking at, because sometimes they're very beautiful places and you think you might know where it is, but you're not 100% sure. If you just simply tap on the trackpad, don't click or don't press any button, just tap lightly on the trackpad, it will bring up the little information that shows up when the screensaver first activates. And so you can get the information that way. Another cool tip is related to something that has always bugged me, especially as a dad. And that is the fact that with the latest version of tvOS, when you're on the main screen and you've selected the TV app, which is the default in the upper left, it will often or always actually automatically starts playing the trailer for whatever piece of content it is recommending. And depending upon what the show is, it may contain scary or inappropriate content, maybe something that you don't want your kids seeing. And granted, there's no audio with it by default, but some of the imagery can be a bit disturbing depending upon the person seeing it. If you do want to get audio and you want to see the full trailer, it is something you're interested in watching, you of course can swipe up and then you get a full screen version of it. But what if you want to do the opposite? What if you don't want to see that content at all, or you don't want it popping up automatically? Unfortunately, Apple doesn't provide a way to just turn off this feature, but there are a couple of things that you could do to give yourself a little bit more control. The first thing that you can do is you can take the app out of the top row of content, which is what Apple calls the top shelf. Only items in the top shelf will display extra content up at the top of the screen. So if you simply take the TV app and move it down out of the top shelf, you won't have that problem. To move apps around on Apple TV, it's very similar to the way you would do it on any other iOS device. You tap and hold on the icon. When it starts to wiggle, you can use the trackpad on the Siri remote to move it down, and then tap, I think, play when you're done, and it will set that in place. I think you could also tap the menu button to exit out of it. So simply move it out of the top row, and that way you never have a chance of it being selected and auto-playing that content. Now, of course, there's other services and content that do similar things, so you might have to move multiple things out of the top shelf. And also, you may be the type of person where you want that content in the top shelf because it's the most easiest, it's the easiest to access from there, right? So I actually like having the TV app as the main thing in the content. Of course, another tip you could do if you do move it out of the top row is always on your Siri remote. Anytime you press the TV button, it will launch the TV app, so you can get to it that way. But I like having mine in the top row, and I don't want to see those trailers necessarily. So another option that you have is to get rid of the what to watch recommendations, which again is now the default with tvOS, and change it over to the what's next options. Now, this is not going to get rid of the trailers automatically playing, but at the very least, it's going to only select content that you've already been watching. So it's going to be shows that you're already aware of. You know what's going on. It still may contain some scary or inappropriate content, so you'll have to make your own judgment on that, but it is another option. So if you do want to switch away from the recommendations, and I think we talked about this a little bit on the past episode of the MacCast too, because it was one of my complaints when Apple switched the software over, is that I'm really more interested in my content and not so much the recommendations that Apple is making to me, because very often those recommendations come from services that I'm not subscribed to, stuff that I can't watch. So that's another reason you might want to change the setting. And it's pretty easy to do. You just open up the Settings app on your Apple TV, you select Apps, and then you select TV, and then you scroll down to the home screen setting, and then you can click to toggle between the modes of what to watch, which are the recommendations, versus what's next. Simply change it to what's next, and then in that top row, when you're on the Apple TV app, it's just going to show you the things that you've already been watching. And then my final tip related to Apple TV comes about because I received an email from a listener who is having some trouble with home sharing and photos that he uses for his screensaver after upgrading to macOS Catalina. This came in from listener Brian, and he was explaining how he was having trouble with the settings. And inadvertently, Brian, you actually helped me discover a issue I was having with my Apple TV that I wasn't even aware of. Well, I was somewhat aware of, but I just hadn't had time to track things down. So after upgrading to macOS Catalina, I did notice that anytime I would try to access the computer's app, basically the home sharing app from my Apple TV, it would say it couldn't connect to my iTunes, that I didn't have an iTunes library available to connect to. And I never really made the connection to the fact that in macOS Catalina, Apple replaced iTunes with Apple Music, and that now syncing an iOS device happens inside the Finder. The music app is really only used for music. They've separated everything. So I didn't really stop to think about, well, what happened to home sharing? Because that used to live inside iTunes as well. And so what I discovered because of your email, or specifically you told me in your email, is that the settings for home sharing have actually moved from iTunes into the system preferences in macOS Catalina. So if anybody else is looking for this, what you want to do is you want to go into system preferences, you want to go into the sharing settings now, and you will see a new option for media sharing. And then under media sharing, you can check on home sharing. And even though I had had home sharing on in iTunes prior to upgrading to macOS Catalina, it looks like once that setting moved, it was no longer enabled or turned on in macOS Catalina. So I was able to check that back on and get those settings turned back on. I also noticed that they kind of beefed up the settings a little bit, and I actually like this new version of it being inside System Preferences, because guess what? Now I don't have to have the application open. A big complaint I had about home sharing in the past was you had to have, I'm pretty sure this is correct, you had to have iTunes open and home sharing enabled in order to share that stuff with your Apple TV. Now that it's in System Preferences, you just need to have the sharing option turned on, and it can share the items from your library. From the settings control panel, you can also change the name of your library, and you can set a number of different options. You can set whether you want your play counts to update. There's a checkbox for that if somebody is playing something via home sharing. And also there is a checkbox to share photos with the Apple TV, which is the setting that Brian was having a little bit of trouble with. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later after we go through some of these other sharing settings, because we want to try to help Brian out with the issue he's having. And I wasn't able to resolve it for him. So I'm hoping some of you in the community can help him out. But if you do check and turn on the share photos option, there are a bunch of other options for choosing the photos that you actually want to share. So once you turn this on, you can click through to the options, and you have the options to share photos in a library or photo or folder rather. So you can pick a specific folder, or you can choose the photos from your photo library. You can choose to share all the photos from your library or a folder, or you can select just individual photo albums or folders. You also have the ability to share only a certain photo album or folders if you want to, and you can share selected albums by clicking on individual photo albums or even click on people from your people albums. So if you just want to share photos from specific people, there's all kinds of controls. So you can basically decide what kinds of photos you want to share. You can also, of course, share videos as well, and you can choose which videos you want to include with your home sharing. And then finally, there is also an option to share media with guests. So by default, the way home sharing works is it works through your Apple ID, and you do need to have the same Apple ID set up for home sharing on all of your devices and Macs. So as long as they're all logged into the same Apple ID, the first set of sharing settings will take effect. Now, there's separate settings for sharing media with your guests, and you can check that on in this setting as well. And then when you click on options, you're given the option to share all songs, movies, and TV shows, or you can select individual playlists. And yes, there are playlists for your home videos, your movies, and your TV shows. And so you can selectively turn those on or off. You can also check the box to require a password so that when your guests sign on, they don't just immediately get access to your media. They actually have to enter a password to be able to access that. And so that would mean if they're on your home network, they'd be able to see that stuff through home sharing without needing to be logged into, of course, your same Apple ID. So a bunch of great granular settings, and it works just like it did before, actually with a little bit more functionality. So I think it's a nice little update in macOS Catalina. So last thing we need to get to is we need to see if we can help out Brian with his issue. So like I said, he was trying to do home sharing of his photos to his Apple TV, specifically for setting them up on his screensaver, because you can move from Apple's default Arial screensaver into a home sharing screensaver. So you can do a screensaver that just uses your photos. And Brian was trying to reset that up after upgrading to Catalina. The problem he was having, though, was that anytime he would go into System Preferences, into the sharing settings, he would check on that box that said, hey, I want to share my photos with Apple TV, and it wouldn't stick. He'd save it, and when he'd come back to it, it would be simply unchecked. So, Brian, I did not run into this issue. It seemed to work fine for me. I'm assuming you're running the very latest version of macOS Catalina. If not, I would recommend upgrading to that. But Otherwise, I'm not really sure how you would fix this problem. Maybe go in and check and see if you could reset the system preferences. So maybe delete the system preferences plist file from your library system preferences folder, if you can find that. And maybe that will allow you to reset your sharing. You might have to reset up all of your sharing settings. I don't know that it's individual for each service. So you could try that. But beyond that, I'm not really sure. But maybe somebody in our community knows. And so if you know a way to fix this for Brian, shoot me an email, send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. And you know what? I had said that was going to be the last thing that we were going to talk about. Well, that was at least the last Apple TV tip that I have for you. I do have one more bit of content to talk to you about, though, and that is a follow-up to using your Apple TV and getting access to live TV content or over-the-air content. As I mentioned on the previous episode, I love my Apple TV. I love using streaming services on it. But one disadvantage for me after cutting the cord is that I don't have a cable TV package, which means that I don't have a lot of options for accessing live TV on my Apple TV because I don't subscribe to services. And a lot of the individual apps for, say, the big three networks, NBC, ABC, and CBS, require that you either subscribe directly to each one of their individual services or that you actually have a cable TV subscription to be able to access their content. You have to kind of validate with your TV subscriber. Well, several folks wrote in to me to mention some alternatives that you can use to get access to live TV and local TV and all that fun stuff. And one of those is to get a streaming service like YouTube TV, Sling, or AT&T that includes that content. My only issue with this is it does still tend to be expensive. It encroaches on the price point for all the channels you might want to get of a standard cable TV subscription. And I've often found, too, that with a number of the services, you get access to a couple of the big three networks, but maybe not all of them. So you might get NBC and ABC, but not CBS. Or you might have a package that gives you CBS and ABC, but not NBC. And so that's been something that I've always been a little bit frustrated by. But those certainly are very good options depending upon what your needs are. And they have different kind of channel packages and price points depending upon the service. And there is a lot of options there. And it does ultimately give you access to live TV content. And, you know, like a big one coming up might be NBC with the Olympics right around the corner. You might want to pick up one of these packages. And you can get a couple month trial or a couple week trial. So that can maybe give you a chance to try out one of these services and see what works for you. So I appreciate those recommendations, and I think that is a good one. Another way that you can do this, and this was pointed out by a number of listeners, is to go over the air with an HD antenna. And then you can combine that with a couple of different hardware tuners that some of which include a digital video recording functionality and apps that work with your Apple TV. And as a matter of fact, Bob wrote in to say that he's very happy with and has just purchased or has recently purchased one called Tableau TV. And I'll have a link to this in the show notes at maccast.com. I haven't personally used it, but Bob says it's his favorite. He's tried out a couple of these different devices. I looked at their website, and the units run between about $99 to $200, depending upon the hardware you want and the features. And really, the main differences seem to be the number of tuners that you might get. So you can have multiple tuners in there, so you can grab and record multiple shows at the same time, or maybe be recording one show and watching another show if you have a couple of tuners in there. And what's nice about this solution is you really have a one-time purchase. You purchase the little tuner box and DVR, then you also purchase an over-the-air antenna, maybe spend a couple $100 and you're up and running, and it's a one-time cost. It's not a subscription. You do need an HD antenna, and the only disadvantage here is you do need to be in an area where you can actually get over-the-air HD signals. Now, depending upon your area, your results may vary. One thing that I thought was very nice about the Tableau TV website is they had a great tool where you could plug in your zip code or you could search by the channels you were looking for, and it would tell you if in your area you are able to get that over-the-air content and how well you might be able to receive that content. Because again, depending upon your area, you may or may not be able to get that. You know, we're going back to the old school days where you might have a big antenna on top of your house. And it does seem to me that, you know, sort of the higher in elevation you are, the better results that you get. Of course, here in San Diego, we're pretty much at sea level, so it's pretty flat unless you're up in the hills. And in my zip code, I really can't get a lot of over-the-air HD content. So this has never really been an option for me, but it might be an option for you. And so I thought it was a great suggestion, and thank you, Bob, for sending that in. I will say, beyond the Tableau TV, there are a number of other people who make this kind of device. Another product that's been recommended to me many times in this area is the HD Home Run from Silicon Dust. So that might be another one that you check out. And if you happen to own one of those and you really enjoy it and want to make a quick review for us or a recommendation, please send that in as well, maccast@gmail.com. But there you go, some options for getting your over-the-air and live TV content on your Apple TV. But with that, I think that will do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Text Expander for iOS, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can check out all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave a voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or you can find me as MacCast on Instagram. Pretty much MacCast on any social media that you prefer, you will find me. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.